Genesis chapter 47, verses 1 to 31. So Joseph went in and told Pharaoh, "My father and my brothers, with their flocks and herds and all that they possess, have come from the land of Canaan. They're now in the land of Goshen." And from among his brothers, he took five men and presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" And they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, as our fathers were." They said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. And now, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them settle in the land of Goshen. And if you know any able men among them, put them in charge of my livestock." Then Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and stood him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How many are the days of the years of your life?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning." And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh. Then Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them possession in the land of Egypt and in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with food, according to the number of their dependents. Now there was no food in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money's gone." And Joseph answered, "Give your livestock, and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock, if your money's gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the herds, and the donkeys. He supplied them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. And when that year was ended, they came to him the following year and said, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent. The herds of livestock are my lord's. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our land. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we with our land will be servants to Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate." So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was severe, and the land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he made servants of them. From one end of Egypt to the other, only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had a fixed allowance from Pharaoh and lived on the allowance that Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they didn't sell their land. Then Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And at the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own, a seed for the field and food for yourselves and for your households and as food for your little ones." And they said, "You have saved our lives. May it please my lord, we will be servants to Pharaoh." So Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth. The land of the priests alone didn't become Pharaoh's. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place? He answered, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear it to me. And he swore it to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed.
Well, thank you, Tom. Let me add my welcome to his. Very nice to see you here with us this morning at St Nick's Church. Particularly welcome if you're visiting here today. I know we've got visitors from Scotland and from Solihull, I believe, and Weybridge. Really great to have you guys with us today. Many others as well, I'm sure, that I haven't had the chance to say hello to yet. But great to be able to welcome everybody. Now, do keep passages open. And you may find on the back of the notes that Tom's drawn our attention to earlier, some sermon notes, an outline of where we're going for our time. The God of Genesis makes promises to his people, and those promises are so watertight, so robust, that his people can and should not just believe them, but sort of line up their lives behind them. At this stage in Genesis narrative, God's people have left the promised land. Jacob and his family, it's quite a big family, we heard the long list of them read out last week, 70 strong. They've now arrived in Egypt, and that begs the question for us, what about the promised land? What about their true home? And that's where the application is really heading today. Where exactly do God's people consider home? Rod Serling, he was a New York playwright. I think he died a few decades back now. He wrote this, not a Christian. He wrote this, everybody has to have a hometown. In the strangely brittle, terribly sensitive makeup of a human being, there is a need for a place to hang a hat, or a kind of geographical womb to crawl back into, or maybe just a place where you grew up. When I dig back, he says, through my memory cells, I get one particular distinctive feeling that's one of warmth and comfort and well-being. For whatever else I may have had or lost, I find I've still got this hometown and nobody's going to take that away from me. We talk about home in slightly different ways, don't we, as people in London, as people that have had different experiences in life, and I guess we will have all had different experiences of home. Mostly positive from knowing the church family, some not so positive. A place of warmth and comfort, perhaps. But as Christians, the Bible lays out another vision of home, a better one, heaven. And as with so many really big and important ideas in the Bible, the vision of being given this bigger and better home, a permanent place, is built up slowly through the biblical narrative. It's not just something that's sort of inserted and then just sort of left and not revisited. It's something that the Bible comes back to again and again. God promises heaven to his people. And the challenge, will we be those who live in light of that, or will we be those who instead decide to carve out an existence here and make this world our home? Well, Genesis is the book, you won't be surprised to hear, where this idea is really enshrined for his people. I guess the language of promised land, which has come up many, many times, like a bit of a broken record through the book of Genesis, draws our attention to this, the promised land, Canaan, the promised land. But just in case at any stage we're in sort of danger of making Canaan, the promised land, something that is sort of rose-tinted, well, the writer in Genesis wants to alert us to the fact that there are serious problems in the promised land. It doesn't deliver what people really need. Only sometimes in small ways through the rest of the Bible do we see it actually delivering, and that's always short-lived. You see, it was never intended to be the final home for God's people. The promised land at best gave a glimpse, and right now in the Genesis narrative, the opposite point is being made. The promised land is a disaster. It's full of famine. If you live there, you'll die. And God's people need to set their hearts on the true promised land, not Canaan, but heaven. And so for God's people today, again, the challenge. Where is your home? In the business of life, the demands of work and family and church, and all of those things that stack up and fill our inboxes and our diary. Where is your heart? For us to be increasingly convinced, as God's people today, for us to be increasingly convinced that heaven is our home, that the new creation is the place to long for, well, we need to see that God is powerful and mighty to deliver on the promises that he keeps making. And that's what I think this text that we heard read just now does. It shows us in some quite remarkable ways that God is able to deliver on this incredible promise. You'll see the first point laid out there. God shows his people that he has the power to deliver on his promises. Joseph and the family, they settle into Goshen, and, well, Joseph, even though he's the sort of the top dog in the land, answerable only to Pharaoh, Pharaoh says, look, whatever you say, Joseph, it goes. But Joseph wants to make absolute sure that everything is done by the letter, and so he brings his family to come and see Pharaoh to make sure that everything is ratified. And what does that do? Well, just before everything is sort of confirmed, he makes sure that they do indeed get the best of the land. You'll see a few subpoints which really, I think, make this point particularly clear. Look at verse 5. Pharaoh said to Joseph, so 47 verse 5, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Settle them in the land of Goshen. It wasn't just survival. If you've been with us so far, you know Goshen was posh. It was the best. Plush houses, fantastic views of the pyramids. Some estimations suggest that the pyramids might have been up for 500 years. They would have been in pretty good condition at this point. I don't know. I'm speculating about that. But this was a posh place. We know that for sure. And it stands, of course, in vivid contrast. Again, the backdrop is famine. And it wasn't just that they had the best of the land. They get the best jobs too. Look how verse 6 continues. Pharaoh says, and if you know any able men among them, that's quite funny because he's looking right now at a group of five of the brothers, and they were obviously the best ones that Joseph could find. He said, well, I'll put these five up. They're the least embarrassing. And Pharaoh says, look, if you know any able men among them, put them in charge of my livestock. In other words, look, Joseph, I trust you to make the decision. Again, you see, this is very significant. As the world faces economic meltdown, jobs for the boys. Joseph lines it all up. Here is a God in sovereign control. He calls the shots. And then with his brothers sorted, that was probably the big headache, you know, put them off in their houses, get them looking after all the sort of the livestock there. With his brothers sorted, it's time to bring in Jacob. Joseph organizes a special meeting between Jacob and Pharaoh. That's the third little subpoint there. They become a blessing to the world. Now, I think this is very easy to overlook and miss the significance of this, but this is really striking in the narrative. Look at verse 7. Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and stood before Pharaoh. Now, I like just the phrasing there. Stood him before Pharaoh, the text says, doesn't it? Stood him before. You get the impression that he sort of somehow propped up on a Zimmer frame before the Pharaoh there. I mean, to be fair, he is 130 years old. It's quite good going at this point. What would you expect to happen, though? Remember, this is the ancient patriarch. He sort of pulled off his mobility scooter and propped up in front of Pharaoh on the Zimmer frame. And remember who Pharaoh is, the most powerful man in the world. He's just opened the doors of hospitality to Jacob and his 70 family. Jacob has every reason to be grateful. I mean, you'd expect, wouldn't you? A bowing of the knee, perhaps? But look at verse 7. Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, stood him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Just in case you missed that detail, the narrator repeats it. Verse 10, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. The ancient patriarch, Jacob, respectful, but he knows to whom his allegiance is due. It is owed to God alone. He bows the knee to no one. One of the commentators blesses the lesser. The narrator then underlines the point in the section. Look at verse 11. Joseph settled his father and his brothers, gave them possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. So I think that raises the question for us. Well, okay, that's all very well. So Jacob blesses Pharaoh. It's not language that we use in our world very often today, is it? What does it mean to be blessed by Pharaoh? Why is it significant? Well, the next sort of big chunk of the text answers that question, verse 13 to 26. Joseph gradually buys up all the land, everything in it, and gives it all to Pharaoh. I mean, it must have been one of the most complicated financial transactions that's ever captured on this planet. The writer just gives it a handful of verses. Verse 14, Joseph gets the Egyptians to spend all their money on his food. When they've got no money left, looks like it's the next year, they decide to go to Joseph and they say, look, we've got no money left. None of us, the whole of the country has spent all their money on your food. We need more food. You've got food. We don't have money. Give us your livestock, says Joseph. Finally, their property. And when they've given property, they have nothing left but themselves. Verse 21, as for the people, he, that is Joseph, made servants of them all from one end of Egypt to the other. Look at the summary then down in verse 23. And Joseph said to the people, behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. I mean, just imagine as that final transaction took place, if Hollywood was doing it, well, I mean, Joseph would sort of sit back in the big leather armchair, light up a big fat cigar and says, that's it, I've done it. I bought everything. Everything now belongs to Pharaoh. That blessing that Jacob gave to Pharaoh, from a material point of view, it was incredible. How do you put a price on that? I've speculated, probably the most significant acquisition that's ever taken place over a series of years in history. Joseph, on the back of it, wise, diligent prime minister that he is, he sets up a taxation system, 20%. People seem very happy with that, and non-biblical writings suggest that that was very generous. The normal at that sort of time across other nations, 33%. They thought they were having a great deal. All this was good for the people. They were treated fairly. They seem grateful. That's the sort of tone you get in the text. Look at verse 25. And they said, this is after they've given him everything and after the taxation's been set up. They said, you have saved our lives. Now, just consider for a moment the impact that all of this should have on us as readers, on the original readers, perhaps. I mean, if this is what happens when Jacob, just a patriarch, blesses Pharaoh, picture of the world, just consider for a moment how much more valuable is God's blessing to his people? I mean, this was a very important lesson for God's people on the ground after Joseph. We knew that the times were good right now, but the decades, the centuries ahead, the tables would be turned and God's people would be treated like dirt. They would go out of favor. They needed to know that God could deliver. They needed to know that when God says he will bless them, well, this sort of story would have resonated as a picture of what real blessing can start to look like. And that's just from the patriarch to Pharaoh. Imagine from God to them. God can deliver. I mean, whatever happens to us as God's people today through the ups and downs of life, so many unpredictable things, aren't there? I mean, a few years ago, who could have ever predicted all of the problems we've had with lockdowns, wars, famine, political and societal meltdown? We've considered these things a bit over the last few weeks. But here is a God who has a credible track record. Here is a God who can actually deliver. That's why we've had the theme, God's might, through the service today. He has the might to deliver. He has a track record of showing us that he does. And he does it all through Joseph. Again, hugely significant. Not a surprise for us if we've been in the Genesis series. Joseph is the Christ figure. He delivers his promises through his Christ figure. That is a pattern that is set down even at this stage. So what's the immediate application for us as we think about all of this? Well, you'll see the second point there. God's people must live in light of this. And you get this in a number of ways through the whole text. I'll just draw your attention to a few of them there. The brothers, okay, that motley crew standing before Pharaoh, trying to sort of look impressive, it seems, getting the jobs. As they stand before Pharaoh, look at verse 2. So back at 47, verse 2. From among his brothers, he took five, presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to the brothers, "What is your occupation?" They said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, as our fathers were." They said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land. We have come to sojourn in the land." Not a word we use every day, I don't think. I'm not aware of it. I'm going around the city very often. It means to stay somewhere temporarily, to be an expat. We have come to be temporary members of this society, is what they're saying. We are not going to be here forever, Pharaoh. We're sojourners. It's quite something, isn't it? We don't want citizenship. And for the brothers to be standing before Pharaoh, it's like they were saying, "Look, just please understand, it's a very privileged position that you're giving us, looking after all your flocks, but we are passing through. We don't belong here." Jacob too. Look what Jacob says as he stands before the Pharaoh in between those two blessings. Okay, he blesses Pharaoh. And then look at verse 8. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How many are the days of the years of your life?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Well, Jacob describes not just his arrival in Egypt as a temporary stay. This is really interesting. He's 130 years old, and he describes his entire life as a life of sojourning. And he spent quite a bit of it in the promised land. But you see, Jacob always knew that there was much more to the promised land than just the promised land. He knew that when God promised the promised land, he didn't actually mean the physical land of Israel. Look what he says to Pharaoh next, though. Look down at verse 9, middle of verse 9. "Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their sojourning." He's obviously a little bit sore about the fact that so far his father and grandfather have lived quite a bit longer than him. But the important point is, by the way, Pharaoh, my father, my grandfather, they were just sojourners too. They didn't actually pretend that they were residents. They were just expats, even in the promised land. They always knew that they were heading to a better country. They always knew that they had heaven in their sights. I love the story. Some of you will have heard me tell this story before. Missionary couple, first half of the 20th century, they spent their working lives explaining the gospel to communities in Central Africa. And one day they decided it was time to return home, time to hand on their work to others. And so they boarded a ship bound for the States. And at the end of their long voyage back to New York, it was finally time for the ship to dock. The gangway was lowered, and they noticed that there was a crowd waving flags and ribbons, and a band struck up. And the missionaries looked at each other, stunned that their church had gone to so much trouble to welcome them home, but the excitement was short-lived. They soon realized that the band and the celebrations were not for them, but were for a returning dignitary coming home apparently from a successful hunting trip. As they got off the ship, they realized that there was nobody there to meet them. Nobody had come to welcome them. Nobody seemed to care. The wife noticed the look of crushing disappointment on her husband's face. And so the story goes, grabbed his hand and just said, "Don't worry, darling, we're not home yet." Well, this was the view of God's people in Egypt, not home yet. Temporary residents passing through. That's why at the end of this section, where Tom finished the reading, Jacob goes through this rather odd ritual of hands underneath thighs and weird promises. I don't know what you made of that. Do ask about it in the question time. I'll be delighted to ask Tom on your behalf. So do please, if you want to. 47 verse 29, just have a glance down at it. "When the time drew near that Israel," that's Jacob, "must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, 'If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt.'" You see, the dying patriarch has a correct perspective of life in this world. Egypt is not his home. Temporary resident, expat. God has in store for me another land. And so the carrying out of his body from Egypt into the promised land, it was a great visual aid to that end. As we draw to the end of Genesis in a couple of weeks' time, we see another sort of curious episode where Joseph dies. And as he dies, he makes everyone around him promise that his bones will be carried out back to the promised land, same point being made. There is, of course, an alternative worldview, and that is shown by the Egyptians. They're not sojourners. If you're not a sojourner, what are you? You're a resident. And the residents have quite a part throughout all of this. You see, they're not passing through. They're people who instead have carved out a life for themselves here. They've made much of this world. And I think the text is structured to bring our attention to the futility of their existence. So you see, if God's people lived in light of his promises, well, the Egyptians just lived. That was all they could do. That's the final sort of sub-point there you'll see on the handout. Have a look at verse 15. When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt, the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and they said, give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? And then you get it twice again in verse 19. Why should we die? Why should we die? End of the verse. Give us seed that we may live and not die. Finally, they achieve their dream. They go to Joseph. They're very grateful. Verse 25, they speak to Joseph and they say, you have saved our lives. But what sort of life is it? I mean, yes, on the one hand, as I've already acknowledged, they were clearly very grateful to Joseph. There seemed to be a happy existence at this stage. And yet, on the other hand, we do see a rather sort of eerie picture of the decline of a nation. Everything sold, money gone, livestock gone, property gone, even their own bodies sold into slavery. It's a rather sort of attention-grabbing picture of people living outside the hope of God's promises. You see, to be outside God's promises means there isn't anything more than just the meaningless pursuit of life in this world and carving out what can be achieved from this world. There are two protected groups that run in parallel to this. We've already drawn our attention to one, of course, Jacob and his family. There's that other little detail about the priests of Egypt. Both of them are protected from this state of servitude. Why both of them? Well, both of them because of their relation to Joseph. Everything's about their relationship to Joseph. Family, of course, the 70 or so, they were related by blood. The priests of Egypt, well, a few chapters back, you may remember, Joseph had married into that family of priests. And so they were protected too. Everybody with a relationship to Jesus, in this case, to Joseph, was protected. And that's the big point, isn't it, that keeps coming out. It is all about the relationship with God's man on the ground, the Christ figure, Joseph for them, Jesus for us. Two worldviews become very clear. God's people, eyes on another country, confident in what God has promised, certainty that God can deliver and will take us there, and living in light of the promised land. And for everyone else, everyone not related to Joseph, well, existence becomes nothing more than just a bit of living. And so I think the challenge for us as we sort of begin to really draw to a close now, the challenge for us, as I said at the start, I mean, where is your heart? That's something to really consider. To what have you given your heart? Let me tell you about David Livingstone. He was an intrepid explorer, a philanthropist. Most of all, according to the biographies, he was a missionary. That's what he was passionate about. And he went about doing his sort of doctoring and everything else, really making much of the Lord Jesus, sharing his faith with lots of people in Africa again. In fact, it was David Livingstone that really inspired that other missionary couple 50 years later to go off to Africa and sort of follow in the work that he paved the way for. So this is the mid-19th century now. He boarded a boat, set sail for Africa. He did some incredible things in terms of exploration, all sorts of things like sort of ascending the Zambezi and exploring the interior of Africa. And I've got a whole long list that I won't read out. But he was passionate everywhere he went with sharing the gospel. One writer puts it like this: he traveled through the heart of this unknown continent wherever he went, he left a trail of light. He died in Africa. His servants decided that they would remove his heart and bury it in Africa, and the body was sent back to the British consul, which was then laid to rest eventually in Westminster Abbey. You can go and see it there, or at least the grave, I guess. And as somebody put it once, his body was returned to the country of his birth, but his heart was placed in the country that he loved. You see, God's people then, God's people today, we know we're heading to the promised land. This world, well, we're just passing through, not home yet. The brothers, they show that so well, don't they? We're just temporary, Pharaoh. Jacob, I won't be here long. My true home is elsewhere. I had a friend who was at the Fleet Street Talk, somebody I got to know some years back now. And he was given a position. He'd been working in an investment bank around there for about 15 years. He was promoted. He had some fancy title, global head of something or other. And after a month in this high-pressured job, he realized it was a mistake. He discussed it with me, and he said, I said, well, why do you think it was a mistake? It sounds like an incredible bit of responsibility. It's great for Christians to be really leading the way. He said, yeah, well, it's all very well, but my attendance at church has suffered. I've had to give up leading a home group, and my ability to share the gospel, I'm just distracted. This is what he said. He decided to ask for a demotion. He went back to his old job. He was absolutely hated by the company, but used very powerfully for the gospel in the years to come. I had another friend who worked at Lloyd's. This is some decades ago. I didn't know him at the time he did this, but he said he became a Christian. I'm going into some lunchtime talks nearby over there, and he became a Christian. And he said he was so passionate about the gospel, he didn't want any extra responsibility. And so what he decided to do was say no to every promotion. And he became the oldest junior underwriter that Lloyd's have ever had. Because he said, well, I've got enough money with what they give me, and I'm very good at my job now because it's not high responsibility. And so I can actually be useful. Jacob settled in a palace, everything he could dream for. Just passing through. It's an incredible vision. One writer puts it like this: to the end, he remains committed to the promised land. He is not bamboozled by the prosperity of Egypt. The writer to the Hebrews, we've been looking at Hebrews not that long ago. The writer to the Hebrews, you may remember this back in chapter 11, gives a long list of all of these incredible sort of patriarchs and people that had lived by faith, examples in the Bible. People like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they're mentioned, as are a number of others. And then the writer concludes, and all of these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us. God will bring his people to heaven, to the new creation. We're challenged to live now in light of this. We're challenged, therefore, not to give ourselves to this world in a way that will somehow damage. Mother Teresa, I don't know much about Mother Teresa. I was really gripped by the fact that when she died, she left nothing in this world apart from a change of clothes and a cooking pot. That was it. Worldly possessions. There's somebody who knows what life consists of. We've been thinking about our giving over the last few weeks. And that's something to work out, to pray about in light of heaven, in light of our true home. I have some friends who came to the conclusion about 10 years ago that for a period of their life, they decided that they would not own a house. I asked them, why? Why will you not own a house? I know you can easily afford one. You've lived in them before. And they said this: because when we rent a house, we remember that we're not here to stay, that we're just passing through. Where is your heart as we close? Do you remember that playwright I mentioned at the start? What was he called? Rod Serling. In the strangely brittle, terribly sensitive makeup of a human being, there is a need for a place to hang a hat, a kind of geographical womb to crawl back into. maybe just the place where you grew up. Well, don't give your heart to things of this world. God has the power to deliver on his promises. And so our challenge, will we be those who live in light of this? Well, I'm just going to pause for a moment. Why don't you just consider something that you want to think about this week and to pray in for yourselves this week, and then I'll close in prayer in just a moment. Loving Heavenly Father, we thank you for giving us promises that are amazing, that are promises to live by. We thank you for showing us that you have the power, the might to deliver on those promises. And we ask that we would be those who don't just believe them, but line up our lives behind them in every respect. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, Chris. Well, why don't we just take a minute, maybe with a neighbour, to think of some questions we might like to ask and to have a look on the Slido at questions that have already been posted, and you can like those if you'd like those to be answered. I was joking earlier, you don't have to type in the full link. Just go to slido.com, type in the code, and then in a minute's time, we'll put some of those questions to Chris.
And to Tom.
Great. Well, let's get going there and keep your questions coming in. We've got 5 or 6 minutes, something like that. Chris, thanks for today. Let's start with just a couple of questions, if we might, on the specifics of today's passage. How did Jacob live so long?
Yeah, it's interesting. As you go through Genesis, you see the ages of people go from very, very large. I think Methuselah, 969, if I remember rightly, he was the oldest person to live. And then I'm getting less and less, and that happens even through the lives of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It diminishes. We don't know for sure. I mean, obviously, when humanity was made, longevity, was eternal life, was very much a possibility before the fall. However, the fall meant that death would come, and it seems that death was introduced slowly, not directly. There seems to be a sliding scale of the effectiveness. So by the time you get to the Psalms, it's quite normal for people to live sort of 70 years. In those days, life was a little bit longer. That's the best attempt I have at an answer there.
Thank you. Another sort of question about the specifics of the passage. Can you say something a bit about the sort of slavery that Joseph puts the Egyptians into? So how is it a blessing for the Egyptians that they become slaves?
Yeah, the problem is the word slave only has negative connotations, doesn't it, in our world today, and there are very good reasons for that, obviously. Slavery in Bible times, I think the word that's used in the Genesis text here is actually servitude. It's quite interesting. To be a servant of a good master is a great thing. And people didn't mind that. And certainly in Joseph's day, it seems that they were quite happy with that arrangement, given the alternative was death. And so we tend to find it quite an abrasive idea. But the idea of being servant of a good master seems to be a good thing. That idea is enshrined. We've been going through Romans in small groups. You do see that idea, don't you? That, you know, you're always slave to somebody. You're either a slave to sin or you're a slave to God. And there is a type of slavery, a type of servitude that is a good thing if the master is good, because the demands are reasonable and just. In God's case, generous and merciful.
Thanks, Chris. Here's one that I'll have a go at. If God is sovereign, are we just puppets? I think the answer is that it's a question of your perspective, really. So Genesis would tell us that God is totally sovereign. Chapter 50, verse 20 would say that God intended something for good while people intended it for evil. But of course, the perpetrators of the evil did not know the end from the beginning. So Joseph's brothers had no idea what was going to happen to Joseph when they threw him into a well, sold him to the Ishmaelites, and so they were responsible for their actions. Silly example, God has already decided the result of the rugby this afternoon, but Joe Marler does not know that. So Joe Marler will be scrummaging for all he's worth, because he doesn't know, as far as he knows. All results are still possible.
Can I add one thing to that? Just very, very quickly, I agree with all of that, really helpful. Every time we make much of one doctrine in the Bible at the expense of another, we always get ourselves into a mess. So yes, God is completely sovereign, absolutely true, but if you extrapolate that and start concluding things, therefore we're puppets, you immediately fall into sort of bear traps and heresy. Alongside God's sovereignty is always the other truth, the other doctrine of human responsibility, and those two things go hand in hand throughout the Bible. God is sovereign, and yet, as humanity, we have decisions to make that have real consequences, and those two things need to be held together, and that's the only way, ultimately, to be faithful to the biblical text.
This one, by far and away the most popular, is it important to build a sense of belonging even though we don't have a home here? Hmm.
Yeah, good question. What do you think?
I'm really interested in what you think.
Yes and no. Yes, I mean, it's wonderful, isn't it? The pictures that we have in the Bible, I love the sort of the homecoming stories. Consider the story of the prodigal son. Isn't it wonderful how the prodigal son runs into the arms of his father? There is the homecoming. I need to go home. I can't remember if that's the language he actually uses when he's feeding the pigs, but it's just this wonderful sort of picture. But we need to remember, this is where the no kicks in, we need to remember that even the best of homecoming stories in this world are just meant to be pictures to give us a taste of what the real homecoming will one day be like. And the problem is, if we make this world everything, we lose sight of the very purpose for which we were made. We need to, you know, in those happy family times, those times when you're away with friends on holiday and you think, this is amazing. Yes, thank God for that. Those are wonderful sort of times of warmth and comfort, to use that rather sort of touchy-feely language from that guy.
We love touchy-feely.
Yeah, I did that for you, Tom. But, you know, we need to remember at those times, thank God, that that's not all we have, because all of those wonderful experiences come to an end or are shattered by illness and death, to put it frankly. The real homecoming will not be tainted by those things and will be worth giving our lives to, giving our heart to.
And I mean, on the subject of belonging, on the question, I mean, it sort of depends what you're wanting to belong to now, doesn't it? So church is going to go on forever. So there must be a right sense in which investing in relationships now and deriving enjoyment from spending time with church family is quite a worthy enterprise, but there aren't going to be insurers in heaven. Mm. And so taking your identity from the fact you work for an insurance firm is probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
How do we focus on heaven when the pull of the world, particularly career advancement, is quite strong? Is pursuing careers that use our gifts a bad thing? Mm.
Yes and no, same sort of principles from before. I think it's really helpful just to think of your career as a sort of temporary secondment. I've got a friend who was speaking in those very terms. I think he's been at the particular law firm that he works at for 28 years. And, you know, he knows it's all just sort of temporary, passing through, all of that sort of thing. You just got to tell yourself, look, this doesn't really matter. I think it's also important to remember what the firm will actually think of you, because they'll spit you out when you no longer make enough money, and they will find people that are cheaper and better at doing what you do. So be careful about giving your heart to an organization that doesn't actually care about you. And that'll be true for all worldly institutions in the end.
If Jacob knew that the promised land wasn't really his home, why did he care where he was buried?
Yeah, that's really good. Thank you. Because of the now and not yet tension that runs through the whole Bible. We had this question in the run-through as well. I think it's such an important idea, but so hard for it to be communicated to people. How do you tell people that you've got to trust something that's not here? You've got to create this, what God does all the way through. He gives us sort of a taste of things without giving us the whole thing. And that happens in all sorts of material terms particularly. And so the promised land was only ever meant to be a picture, but it was a good picture. And by the time you get to Solomon, I mean, it's an amazing picture. You see the promised land sort of living, everyone in it sort of living in glory and splendor and riches. And the Queen of Sheba comes in and just sort of says, wow, this is what sort of God have you got? This is amazing. And that's all great, but it's short-lived to remind everybody that, of course, this is not where it's at. There are problems. It's always spoiled by death in the end. And so there's a now and a not yet. How does Jacob tell the next generation that you've got to not hope in Egypt, you've got to hope in the promised land? Take my body to the promised land. How does Joseph do it? Take my bones back into the promised land. But the promised land was never actually the place to go. Don't you remember Joseph? Don't you remember Jacob? They were just sojourners, even in the promised land.
That's very helpful. Loads of questions. This is the final one we're going to ask now. If this isn't our home, what's the point in doing anything here? Investing times in things like a degree? Actually, I think we can now narrow down who asked that question to just a very small number of people in the room.
Yeah, so the three students like to come and see me afterwards. That'd be... that's great. It's good though. Like a career, like a degree, like anything. Because throwing ourselves into things wholeheartedly is a good thing. God has made this world and he's given us interactions and he's given us relationships and he's given us opportunity. He's given us health and wealth and all of these things. They're good things given by God. We've just got to remember that they're not ultimate things. Throw yourself into your degree, but remember your degree is no good for getting into heaven. Remember why you're at university, guys. Sorry, one of them's my son, I can speak like that. Remember why you're at university, remember why you're in your careers, etc.
Chris, thanks so much. Loads more questions we could think about. Can I suggest that in a moment, where we're sitting, we discuss